John Neusing here to talk about his book that we published at the beginning of the summer. And I'd just like to say I'm very, very proud to have published it. And I do think it's a book that combines very serious scholarship, but with a very accessible a style. And it's a book that you can both read with immense intellectual satisfaction on its own, but also, like the best socialist scholarship, it is also a weapon in the struggle. And I think that's something that that John should be very proud of producing. So I'm going to introduce John. He's going to speak for about half an hour, and then there'll be time if people want to ask any questions or make any comments, and then John will come back and we can carry on the discussion and no doubt have some more wine and so forth. So, John.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Mark and Bookmarks for getting the book out in the remarkable time that they did, and I think that was an amazing achievement, incredible amount of work. I mean, writing it was one thing, but the speed with which it was published was quite remarkable. Anyway, enough of that. For me, the starting point really has to be a brief look at the rest of the sort of history of the British Empire. And I think, the more you look at the main sort of body of academic work and popular work on the British Empire, the more depressing it becomes in many ways. If you look at all the various standard books, I think it's fair to say that whether they situate themselves on the right, the sort of Neil Ferguson, Andrew Roberts stuff, you get the impression with Roberts, for example, that he's there at Amritsar with General Dyer, And wanting to give the order to fire himself, that this is the sort of degree of identification. It's clear where he stands, but even people who are situated more on the left, I think by and large what you've got is history that is at bottom an apology for the empire. And I've developed what I like to think is a sort of test for histories of the empire, general histories and histories of the empire in the 20th century. And really this is, how do they deal with the Bengal famine of 1943? The Bengal famine of 1943, you had something like 3 million people starved to death. The Viceroy, Lord Wavell, described it as the worst disaster to ever befall people living under British rule. There's no doubt that the famine relief measures were an absolute scandal. And there is a question mark, to say the least, over the role that Winston Churchill played. You had one occasion, for example, where Mountbatten, who was one of the military commanders, offered Wavell 10% of his shipping to carry food to India. And when Churchill found out about this, he cut Mountbatten's shipping allocation by 10%. You have Wavell himself comment on the fact that the response that pleas for food aid to feed the starving Dutch, for example, when Holland was liberated, these met with a much more generous hearing than pleas to feed the Indians. And you actually had Churchill himself remark that the Bengal thing wasn't so much of a problem because, as he put it, the Indians bred like rabbits. How do these books deal with this? The simple answer is that they don't. You look at any of the standard books, you look at Neil Ferguson, doesn't deal with the Bengal famine of 43 at all. You look at Andrew Roberts, doesn't deal with it at all. You look at Trevor Lloyd's book, doesn't deal with it at all. You look at Dennis Judd's acclaimed book, doesn't deal with it at all. Indeed, Judd, who is not a reactionary, Judd in his biography of Nehru, doesn't deal with the Bengal famine of 43 there either. You even look at someone like Bernard Porter, who I've got a lot of respect for as a historian. Nevertheless, you look at his book, The Lion's Share, one of the standard books on the history of the British Empire. He doesn't mention the Bengal famine of 1943. And I don't think this is an accident. I don't think it's an accident. I think what you have is something that is so bad that it cannot be fitted into the general interpretation of the empire that prevails. So even those critics, nevertheless, criticise it, if you like, from a point of view that accepts it in general. You know, what you don't have is an anti-imperialist stance that I think can cope with something like the Bengal famine without any difficulty at all. And, you know, this really, for me, has become a sort of test. You know, the first thing I do now is any book on the empire that I pick up, I look to see what does it have to say about the Bengal famine. And depressingly, what you find is time and time again, the books have nothing to say at all. Let me stay on a little bit talking about India. When you look at you know, the history of India approaching independence, what you find, of course, is that the Labour Party has managed to create the impression that India got independence at the gift of the Attlee government. You know, the Attlee government gave India independence. This is one of its great achievements, that Clement Attlee himself, you know, can lay claim to being the man who set India free. What I would argue, and this is not an original idea, another historian actually argued this, what I would argue is that this is an invented myth, if you like. When you come to look at what Labour actually proposed at this time, when they came into office, they accepted that something would have to be done about India. You know, that the old way of ruling India was not something that could continue. Something would have to be done, but as far as they were concerned, the nature of the game was to find some way of maintaining British control over India and ensuring that India's resources remained available to the British Empire at the same time as giving the appearance of independence. And the idea they came up with was that they would somehow balkanise India. They would break it up into different sovereignties so that none of these sovereignties on their own would be strong enough to stand up to Britain, and Britain could continue to exercise some sort of domination over all of them. And these were days of comparative political honesty. I use the word comparative. These were days of comparative political honesty. The plan they came up with for the balkanisation of the Indian subcontinent, they handily called the Balkan Plan. Today they call it the Freedom Plan. You know, in those days they handily called it the Balkan Plan, and this was the idea that they would divide India up, and that British bases would remain in India, and that Indian troops would be available for the propping up of the British Empire in other areas. This is what they hoped to achieve, and in fact, you know, this broke down for two reasons, really. First of all, well. Three reasons. Let me give you three reasons. First of all, the Congress Party wouldn't accept this. The Congress Party was not prepared to accept that it was going to remain subordinate to Britain, and would not accept that Indian troops were going to be used to continue propping up the British Empire elsewhere. But what you also had was a growing unrest in India, growing political and social unrest, and also growing communal conflict. You know, these two things developing in India, and it became quite clear to the military, to the people on the spot, that India could not be held, and that something was going to have to be done dramatically. You know, that in the end, they were going to have to pull out of India because the thing was escaping out of control. One of the generals of the day said it was like a ship that was on fire, and it was only a matter of time before the flames reached the powder magazine. This was the position we were in India. You know, this is the way it was described. And you know, what you get is, interestingly enough, you know, the people in the Labour cabinet, Ernest Bevin in particular, wanted to hang on to India. You know, Bevin was very concerned about Britain's international position. As far as he was concerned, India strengthened Britain's international position. This was something to be held on to. And you actually had the situation where you know, you had the generals saying to Bevin, no, we can't hold on to it. You know, it's not something we can continue to hold on to. You've got to give it up, Ernie. This is not the first government where the generals have been to the left of the Labour Party. You actually had a situation where Bevin had to be told that India could not be held. And you know, what you have, of course, is independence being granted to India. Well, you know, granted is the wrong word. India becomes independent, and really, you know, a huge hole is knocked in the British Empire. What I want to focus more on, though, is the Middle East. I think developments in the Middle East are very interesting, obviously, from a historical point of view, but they're also interesting because they are so relevant as far as the situation today is concerned. And when you come, you know, when you look at the Middle East in this period with the 45-51 Labour government, what you find is that Britain is still the dominant imperial power in the Middle East. But this domination is coming under attack, really from two directions, I would argue. On the one hand, you had a rising nationalist movement. This is one side of the pincer, if you like. But I think quite often something that's neglected is that from the other angle, you actually had the Americans wanting to replace the British Empire with their own influence. You know, there was sort of pincer movement, if you like, that was coming together to squeeze the British position in the Middle East. Let me start with Iran. You know, if you look at Iran, when the Labour Party come to power, Iran is pretty much dominated by Britain. It's not part of Britain's formal empire, it's part of Britain's informal empire, where you know, you have an Iranian government running the country, but really the bottom line is it doesn't interfere with the activities of the Anglo-Iranian oil company, which is you know, producing huge profits from the oil industry in Iran, and these profits are overwhelmingly going to the benefit of Britain rather than to the benefit of the Iranian people. This is the situation that exists in Iran. It's a situation that comes under serious challenge when the Labour Party comes to power, and you actually have a nationalist prime minister appointed on the back of a popular movement. Mossadegh is appointed prime minister and sets about nationalising the oil industry. And what's interesting is to look at the Labour government's response. You actually have Emmanuel Shinwell, you know, one of the former Glasgow radicals, you know, it's a very radical man just after the First World War. Just after the Second World War, Shinwell actually says that if we let the Iranians nationalise the oil industry, the next thing you'll know, the Egyptians will be nationalising the Suez Canal. Very, very perceptive, very perceptive. What you get, of course, is, you know, the Labour government seriously discusses military intervention in Iran to protect the Anglo-Iranian Oil Corporation. You actually had a situation where the corporation sold oil to Britain cheaper than it sold it to Iran. You know, this is the way it worked, that the profits, the taxes the oil corporation paid to the Labour government were more than the taxes it paid to the Iranian government. And of course, not only that, but the company was part owned by the British government as well. They seriously discussed military intervention to bring Mossadegh down and to take the oil industry, in particular the Aberdeen oil refinery, back into British control. And once again, these were days of honesty. They came up with a plan which they called Operation Buccaneer. You know, once again, today it would be Operation Freedom, Operation Liberation. You know, they call, you can imagine, if this had gone on, they'd have had Operation Pillage, Operation We're Going to Take Everything You've Got. You know, you can see the sort of, this was, these were comparatively honest days compared to today. The reason they didn't invade, you know, the cabinet was split, to be fair. But in the end, what tipped the balance decisively in favour of those who didn't want military intervention was the fact that the Americans made quite clear they wouldn't go along with it. You know, already the United States was calling the tune in the Middle East, and you actually had the Labour cabinet take a decision that they would not go in the face of American objections in order to defend British interests in Iran. And the outcome, of course, is that eventually Mossadegh is overthrown by a CIA MI6-sponsored coup, and what comes out of it is a rejigging of the shares as far as the oil industry is concerned. And whereas the British had previously had an absolute domination of the Iranian oil industry, what is, you know, when the things are divvied up again under the Shah, it's the Americans who have the predominant interest. And you have, for example, Anthony Eden, you know, who later on becomes Prime Minister, is outraged by this, along with many other Conservatives. And you have Eden, you know, actually complaining that the Americans, in his own words, want to rule the world. You know, and this was not an anti-imperialist objection, of course. This was an imperialist objection because the Americans wanted to rule our bit of the world as well. You know, this is where the objection comes from. The next step in the destruction of the British position in the Middle East is, of course, you know, Nasser's nationalisation of the Suez Canal. You know, Emmanuel Schimmel was quite right. You know, the Suez Canal would be next, and you get, I think, you know, a very remarkable sort of set of political developments take place in 1956. You know, it's the anniversary this year. A very remarkable set of political developments take place. With a colonial war being manufactured on the basis of a sort of a body of lies that I think would make George Bush and Tony Blair blush. And you know, that is something. You know, the body of lies that surround the Suez invasion are, I think, historically quite remarkable. Now, I would make the point that all colonial wars are based on lies. When you have a war where you have an advanced power with an advanced military attacking a backward country which is in comparison virtually disarmed, almost invariably these wars are justified on the basis of lies. You know, and if you look back at, say, the Opium Wars, or if you look back at the invasion of Egypt in 1882, you know, these wars are based on lies. We know in all these wars exactly how many British soldiers died because they counted them. You know, we don't know how many of the natives died because they didn't count them. You know, and there's nothing new in what happens today in Iraq. They counted the number of the dead from the British Army. You don't bother. There are so many of them anyway. Who knows who they are? You know, I mean, the Battle of Tel El Kebir, we know down to the last soldier how many British soldiers died in 1882. The number of Egyptian dead is 10,000 perhaps. You know, 10,000 perhaps, we don't know. You know, there is just an estimate. There's nothing new as far as that is concerned. When you come to look at Suez, though, what you have is a situation where they want to bring Nasser down. Eden, the Prime Minister, is absolutely hysterical. You know, he calls for Nasser to be murdered. He wants him brought down. In many ways, the response is an irrational response. You know, Britain had occupied Egypt in 1882 and had only really finally agreed to evacuate the country in 1954. And then after a low-level guerrilla campaign that was making the bases there a military, you know, that they were becoming a problem rather than an advantage. And the idea, of course, of invading again in 56 to bring Nasser down, you know, if you couldn't keep control of the country when you already had thousands of troops there, what was the expectation that an invasion would work? I think those people at the time who argued that this was irrational, you know, were absolutely spot on, that it's very hard to find a rational justification for the Suez invasion, you know, when you place it into the context of the circumstances. But nevertheless, you know, what I think motivated the government was that they were worried that if they didn't do something about Nasser, then the whole Middle East was going to slip from their grasp, and that something had to be done, even if it smacked of desperation. You know, this was the last roll of the dice. Everything had to be bet on it, because really, if something wasn't done now, then the whole situation was going to slip away. And it would be the nationalists on the one hand and the Americans on the other who would inherit, if you like, the British position in the Middle East. What they came up with was what I suppose Baldrick would describe as a cunning plan. You know, what you would have was the Israelis would invade Egypt. Now, to be fair, the Israelis were quite keen to invade any of their Arab neighbours at this time. They actually did suggest, you know, that they should occupy the West Bank, which was part of Jordan. Ben Gurion actually suggested they should occupy the Lebanon up to the Litani River. You know, the British regarded Jordan as one of their clients. The French still regarded the Lebanon as one of their clients, so that they ruled that out. But nevertheless, what you had was the Israelis were quite prepared to attack Egypt. And what the British came up with, the British and the French together came up with, was a plan whereby once the Egyptians had attacked, they would intervene in order, you know, posing as peacemakers to protect the Suez Canal. You know, that they would actually intervene and they would be not on either side, they would just intervene to protect the Suez Canal and to separate the two protagonists. The Israelis, in fact, were counting on the Royal Air Force destroying the Egyptian Air Force. The Israeli army didn't have the superiority that it had in the 60s and into the 70s at this time. They were still counting on the RAF destroying the Egyptian Air Force. The whole thing was a put-up job The British and the French would present an ultimatum. Both sides had to evacuate from the Suez Canal zone. For the Egyptians, this would involve their forces retreating over 100 miles. For the Israelis, it would involve their forces carrying on a further 100 miles. And as the Israelis were the aggressors, there was a confident expectation that Nasser wouldn't swallow this. And when he wouldn't, then we would attack. This was the plan, a cunning plan. You actually have Rab Butler, for example, as it explained to him by the Foreign Secretary, Selwyn Lloyd. And Butler says, "This is indeed a cunning plan, but I suspect people will see through it." This was very perceptive on his part. And the fact of the matter is, people saw through it almost immediately. Interestingly enough, the Israelis had a sort of very contemptuous attitude that they regarded the British as so many hypocrites. They were quite prepared to invade someone in an unprovoked way. There's no problem with that as far as they were concerned. The British wanted to invade someone but pretend they weren't. And that they were very contemptuous of this. So the Israelis weren't really interested in trying to cover anything up. The French were barely interested in covering anything up. But with the British, what you had was a grim determination to never admit what had gone on. And the men who had been involved in taking this decision and being part of this conspiracy, these men denied it, really, until the day they died. Eden, Selwyn Lloyd, they all denied that there'd been any collusion. My favourite is Lord Kilmuir. Some of you might know Lord Kilmuir because he was in the, the Croydon shooting. The Let Him Have It shooting, when the jury recommended that the bloke they hanged have clemency, whatever it is. Lord Kilmuir, as Home Secretary, decided not to hang him anyway. I just thought I'd throw that in. I don't like the bloke on principle, really. But Lord Kilmuir had been an Attorney General. He'd been the Attorney General. If you can't trust the Attorney General, who can you trust? I ask you. He'd been the Home Secretary. He'd been the Lord Chancellor. This was a man of unimpeachable integrity. I often think unimpeachable integrity is a sort of another way of saying a posh liar. But this was a man of unimpeachable integrity. And in his autobiography, Lord Kilmuir says, "Those people who say there was collusion with the Israelis are lying." We now know that this man who'd held all the top legal positions in the land was lying through his teeth up until the day he died. And I honestly think we can't expect any less of the current government today. They will be denying what went on, the Downing Street memo, the significance of all these things will be denied up until the day they die. This is just the nature of things. This is how these people work. Things might well be admitted in America with a different system of government, in Britain, with the collusion of the majority of MPs in the House of Commons. What you will have is this being denied and denied, even when everyone knows what went on. They will continue denying it till they're blue in the face. This is just the way the British system works. Pardon me. What happens in Suez, of course, is that the Americans pull the plug. The United States have no interest in seeing British imperialism reassert itself in the Middle East. The Americans bring the invasion to a halt by economic and political pressure. And in all honesty, I think, in fact, that Eisenhower did Britain a favour. My own view is that if the invasion had gone ahead and had been successful, then what you would have had, in fact, was Britain being involved in a protracted guerrilla war, confronting a protracted insurgency. Nasser had distributed arms to the people. He had ordered the assassination of anyone who collaborated. My own view is that there would have been a protracted guerrilla war. And one shouldn't forget that this had been one of the reasons why we got out anyway in 54. And there's no doubt in my mind that this would have involved a large number of British troops. Divisions of British troops being stationed there indefinitely. And my own view is that conscription wouldn't have been abolished in the 1960s, and someone like me might well have been called up anyway. Eisenhower, actually, I owe him a personal debt of gratitude for forcing Britain to withdraw from Suez. The Americans pull the plug. What's interesting, of course, is that you get a very different response from the French on the one hand and the British on the other. And I think this is one of the key factors, if you like, in understanding where we are today. The French are not as close to the Americans as we are anyway. The French are already more committed to Europe than Britain is. But the conclusion the French draw from Suez is that they will never put themselves in the position where the Americans can do the dirty on them again. France takes the decision that it will go its own way. In the 60s, you get de Gaulle ordering all American troops out of France. France is committed to having a nuclear deterrent because it wants great power status. It will have its own nuclear deterrent, not one that it gets from the Americans. And what the French do, I would argue, is try to build up Europe, in particularly an alliance with West Germany, as a counterweight, if you like, to the United States. I think you have a very deliberate decision on the part of the French that their regional interests will not be left at the mercy of the Americans, that instead they will try to build up some counterweight that will enable them to, you know, withstand American pressure to defend what they regard as their imperial interests. I don't think one should be sentimental about this. You know, there's a lot of evidence, for example, coming to light recently about French involvement in Rwanda. You know, so I'm not suggesting that there's some sort of moral superiority on the part of the French. What the French were doing was pursuing what they saw as their best interests by pulling away from the United States. What you get on the British side, of course, is a determination to never fall out with the Americans again. Britain will subordinate it to the itself to the United States, and if this requires British prime ministers to suffer the indignity of appearing as courtiers to the Americans, then so be it. You've got to feel a bit sad, really, as far as Tony Blair is concerned. You know, Macmillan had Kennedy, Wilson had Johnson, Blair has got George W. Bush. You know, I mean, there is the whole thing is a sort of great tragedy. Just putting the two names together, you know, poor Tony, he gets George W. Bush to be the man that he has to play courtier to. Nevertheless, what I would argue is when you look at the actual policy, it is a consistent policy of sticking as close to the Americans as possible. When Christopher Mayer was sent out as ambassador to Washington, quite famously he was told, you've got to get up the White House's arse and stay there. You know, and while this is anatomically correct, you know, and certainly the idea of soldier to shoulder doesn't actually fit the British positioning. Nevertheless, I would argue this is not something that is true just of Blair. This was true of Macmillan in the period after Suez as well, that the intention was to get as close to the Americans as possible. And on occasions, sacrifice Britain's regional interests in order to preserve Britain's larger global interests. And what I would argue is that the reason they took this decision is not because they were gutless, not because they were spineless, not because they were lacking moral fibre. You know, all these things might be true of individual politicians, but you can't see the whole direction of Britain's strategic policy as deriving from character failings. What you actually had was understanding of where Britain's interests lie. I would argue that compared to the French, Britain had global interests. And as far as the British ruling class was concerned, these global interests regarded a state with a global reach to defend them. Once upon a time, the Royal Navy had been able to do that. What you had, though, in this period, in the late 50s, was a recognition that the only country with that sort of global reach was the United States. And because of this, because Britain has global interests as compared with the French, for example, what you have is the determination to stick with the Americans and on occasions be prepared to sacrifice regional interests in order to preserve, you know, the larger interests of British capital. I think you can see that the policy follows on from this sort of decision, and these things were discussed. The Conservative Cabinet, Macmillan's Conservative Cabinet, actually discussed this with some people in the Cabinet urging that they follow the French route. You actually had people urging in Macmillan's government that they go in with the French to produce a European bomb, for example. But when you looked at it rationally, you know, how could an alliance with the French protect British global interests? It hadn't even been able to topple NASA. The only way that British global interests could be protected was by sticking with the Americans. And I think everything follows on from that. You know, that Blair's rather undignified position of playing courtier to someone who's obviously not the sharpest pencil in whatever you keep pencils in. You know, this is very undignified, but he is doing it for the interests of British capital. You've got to give him credit. He is making himself look. His reputation has been ruined, but he's done it all, I would argue, in the interests of British capital, because as far as they're concerned, Britain's interests require this close alliance with the United States. Pardon me. Let me just give you one example of where they sacrificed regional interests. I mean, this is, if you look at the case of British Guyana, for example, you know, you had this British colony coming up to independence. You had Chedi Jagan as the Prime Minister, a reformist government, and Kennedy indicated that the Jagan government was totally unacceptable. The United States would not tolerate Jagan being the Prime Minister when British Guyana became independent. Macmillan argued with him. The colonial secretary actually said to the Americans, if I had to choose myself, if I was Guyanese myself, and I had to choose between Jagan and Forbes Burnham, the American candidate, Burnham is a gangster, I would choose Jagan. You know, you actually had a conservative say he'd rather live under a Jagan government than under a government of gangsters. Kennedy insisted, though, there was no bottom line on this, Jagan had to go. And what you have is the British government actually agreed to massive CIA intervention in a British colony to bring Jagan down. This is condemned by Harold Wilson, of course. You know, Harold Wilson condemns the constitution that was introduced to manoeuvre Jagan out of power. And then, of course, once he gets into office himself, he finds that this is something that the Americans don't regard as negotiable. And it's Harold Wilson's government that actually introduces the measures that bring Jagan down and put Forbes Burnham into power. You know, a local interest was sacrificed in order to keep him with the United States. There are other occasions when Britain stood up to the United States, let me hasten to add. You know, if the interest, especially if it was an oil interest, if Britain was quite prepared, for example, in Oman and Dhofar to stand up to the Americans and the Saudis. But nevertheless, you know, this was, if you look at it in general terms, the key to understanding British policy is that they will stick to the Americans no matter what. The only exception is the Heath government. Heath took Britain into the European Union. I think Heath is the nearest we've got to a Gaullist. Heath tried to distance himself from the United States. And you actually have a remarkable situation in 73 with the Yom Kippur War, where the French refused the Americans overflight rights to fly munitions to Israel. The West Germans refused the Americans overflight rights to fly munitions to Israel. And so does the Heath government. This is pretty unprecedented. You know, to have a British government stand up to the Americans, especially over Israel, is unprecedented. No Labour government would have done it, in my opinion. Certainly the Wilson government wouldn't. Wilson was a staunch Zionist. The Heath government actually stood up to the Americans over this. Heath, of course, was not a left-winger. I mean, compared to New Labour, he might look left-wing today, but Heath was a cold warrior and a class warrior. But nevertheless, as far as he was concerned, he actually put it that it's not in the interests of Britain to have a British Prime Minister leaning on the shoulder of the Americans. I think the British ruling class decided otherwise, you know, and that the Heath experiment, if you like, is short-lived. But nevertheless, even today, there are people in the Conservative Party who argue for that sort of positioning. I don't think there is anyone in the Labour Party arguing for that sort of positioning. Let me just end with some remarks about New Labour. While in many ways I would say they've broken with everything to do with social democracy domestically. I mean, I've just read David Blunkett's so-called diaries, 800 and something pages. I'm thinking of claiming industrial injury for this. It's pretty dire stuff, and you can't actually, I think, in all honesty, you can't believe barely a word he says in the whole thing. And you know, he's in the remarkable position of a former reactionary Home Secretary who's had the former head of the armed forces, the former head of the prison service, and the former head of the Metropolitan Police all call him a liar publicly. I mean, this is an amazing, unprecedented achievement, I think, you know, absolutely unprecedented. What you've got, I mean, once upon a time, someone like Blunkett, if he'd have held the views he holds today, he would have defected to the Conservative Party, you know. It shows how low our political expectations have become in many ways, but he would have defected to the Conservative Party. The fact he doesn't today is because the whole bloody Labour Party has defected, if you like. You know, that he doesn't have to leave the Labour Party today because they're all like that. If you think about it, to have a senior Labour politicians consorting with someone like Rupert Murdoch, before Blair, this would have been unthinkable. I mean, think about it. It would have been absolutely unthinkable to have senior Labour politicians consulting with a man who had prosecuted a year-long lockout to destroy the print unions. You know, it would have been unthinkable to have Labour politicians consorting with someone like that. Today, we accept it as absolutely routine. It's part of the political process. You know, it's just something that is a bit unsavoury. I mean, Blair, as I'm sure some of you know, someone tried to get under the Freedom of Information Act the information about how many times he's communicated with Murdoch since he's been in office, and they've completely failed to find out how many times these men have been in contact with each other. One suspects, because it would seem scandalous, you know, that this would have been unthinkable. Today, it's just taken for granted. This shows, I think, how low our expectations have become. When you come to look at foreign policy, though, I think their foreign policy has been absolutely consistent. I don't think there's been any serious change. What has changed is that the left-wing opposition has shrunk. You know, the voices of the left are nowhere near as loud as they used to be. That's the most significant difference. But in terms of what Labour governments do, I would say this government is no different significantly from previous Labour governments. Now, let me just look at the example of Harold Wilson and Vietnam. Wilson refused to send British troops to Vietnam. He came under a lot of pressure, and very famously, one American official said, you know, you never even sent the Black Watch. Why they singled out the Black Watch is... And you know, presumably they were expendable, Scottish expendable, you know, send them to Vietnam. The reason Wilson didn't send British troops, I think, is, you know, there are a number of a complex of things. Wilson had been the left-wing candidate for the leadership of the Labour Party. The left-wing in the Labour Party at that time was much stronger and more determined than it is today. Michael Foot actually said on one occasion that if British troops went to Vietnam, the left would tear the Labour Party apart. In these circumstances, Wilson chose not to send British troops. They also put to the Americans that if British troops went to Vietnam, then they would expect American troops being sent to Malaysia to help confront the Indonesians, you know, because the confrontation was going on at the time. When you come to look at it, though, Wilson gave the Americans absolute and total diplomatic support right the way through the war. There's only one exception. In 1966, the Labour government disassociated itself from a particular bout of bombing, and we now know that the actual terms of the disassociation were agreed with the Americans beforehand. You know, that the fact that we were defying them, if you like, was agreed with the Americans, that they wouldn't mind too much beforehand. There's no doubt that Gaitskill, if he'd have been alive, the previous Labour leader, would have sent British troops to Vietnam. I've no doubt in my own mind that if you could sort of transport Blair back, Blair would have sent British troops. But it was the degree of opposition that existed in the country, the fact that you still had a lively left inside the Labour Party. I mean, I lived in Hull. I was a student in Hull at this time. John Prescott used to buy Socialist Worker. Hard to believe, comrades. You know, but John Prescott, and he always used to show some interest in how the lads were getting on. You know, you look where he'd come from, you can see, you know, Prescott, the early Prescott, the young Prescott, if you like, wasn't what he has since become by any means. This was a very different situation. What you have today, though, I would argue, is a situation where the changes that have taken place in the Labour Party have really managed to separate itself off from any, you know, from the amazing anti-war movement that you had, much bigger than the anti-Vietnam War movement. I mean, one of the things in Blunkett's memoirs that sticks in my mind, most of it fortunately sort of deleted itself as I read the stuff, but he actually says about the, you know, the big 2 million demo. How do you count that many people? You know, a sort of plaintive cry. How do you count that many people? What is interesting is that the Labour Party has managed to isolate itself, if you like, from what used to be the sort of people who would have been its supporters. It's isolated itself, it's managed to separate itself off from them to such an extent that they can ignore that march. And you can actually have the situation where Blair will give evidence to Americans about the Gulf War, but when it comes to an inquiry in Britain, you only have a shameful... I must admit, I was incredulous that only 12 Labour MPs voted in favour of an inquiry in Britain. One of them, interestingly enough, was my local MP. I don't claim any credit for that at all, because I never even voted for him, but, you know, never mind. But, you know, this is a remarkable situation. The real danger is, of course, you know, that their commitment to the Americans still holds. Everyone knows that all this talk of British troops coming out of Iraq, it'll be when the Americans say we can. However long British troops are going to be in Afghanistan, it'll be as long as the Americans say we've got to. And what I would argue as well, and this is the really dangerous terrain, we are going to see other wars. You know, this is not we have not seen the last of America's wars. We are going to see other wars. And I think both Labour, and if the next government is a Conservative government, these governments are going to be absolutely committed to supporting the Americans in these other wars as well. The reason we will see other wars, and I know it's depressing, but nevertheless I think it's inevitable, is of course because America's economic domination has faded away, and they are increasingly relying on military muscle, and of course they have the military muscle, they have the reach, but as things have shown, they haven't got the grasp, and I think we are in for a very dangerous time. And we are going to see British troops be involved in other conflicts where not only are British troops going to be dying, of course, but you're also going to have British troops killing large numbers of other people as well. And this is something we've got to do our best to stop.
Thanks. Okay, if people have got any questions or points they'd like to make, if they just want to raise a hand, and I'll...
Can I ask you this quick question about the subtitle? Is it actually an allusion to A.L. Morton's People's History of England, or is that just an accident? Because I think that's still in print, and it was one of the first Marxist histories of British history.
I've read that years ago, and I suppose that's always in one's mind. But to be honest, it's the the Zinn book, the Howard Zinn book.
Maybe he took it for A.L.
Well, I'm sure he did, actually. But I think, to be fair, that was more influence on me than the A.L. Morton book. But like you said, I'm sure he pinched it off Morton anyway. So it's come via the Atlantic. But, my missus said, call it that. I had a different title altogether. And my wife said, that's the best title. And I think, in retrospect, she's not here, so I can freely admit this. In retrospect, she was right. It works.
Could you please tell us the class aspect in what you have just analysed?
I mean, this is a brief talk, yeah, and the intention has been to demonstrate a particular analysis of British imperialism and the way British imperialism has developed recently. In terms of a class analysis, I mean, there are two ways to approach this. First of all, I would say, if I'd done a longer version of the talk, a chunk of the talk would have been looking at those moments in the history of the British labour movement when you have had British working class people adopt an anti-imperial stance. You know, the book takes as its title, The Blood Never Dried. This is Ernest Jones. The Chartist talking about the British Empire. I'd have looked at William Morris and the opposition that the Socialist League mounted to the invasion of the Sudan. I'd have looked at the working class opposition to Governor Eyre when he came back in 1865 from suppressing the Jamaica Revolt. And what I would have tried to do is to, you know, establish the fact that when the British working class has been fighting in its own interests, then at that time you've also had the British working class, or at least sections of the British working class, take up the interests of other oppressed groups as well. But like I say, you know, there is a question of time, but hopefully the book deals with that in more detail. But I think you can clearly see that although history is portrayed as a sort of glorious imperial panorama, there have been plenty of occasions when British socialists and British working class people have took a stand against the empire.
In your book, where did you get the information about Kenya and the Mau Mau? Because I can remember what newspapers said, and I just wonder where you found your information.
It's interesting. I mean, recently there's been a marvellous book by a bloke called David Anderson called Histories of the Hanged, which is I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book. I'm green with envy, you know, that I think this is it's not just good about Kenya, it's a model of historical inquiry, in my opinion. I don't know if you've got it on sale here, but it's a wonderful book. And I think that's the definitive statement that the realities of Kenya. But in fact, if you go back to even when the emergency was on, you know, you did have people at the time arguing that terrible things were being done. And what tended to happen was that those voices were just ignored. The overwhelming weight of the propaganda was that it was a heroic band of whites being confronted by sort of black savagery and black barbarism. And I think that it even dominated to the extent that the revolt is known as the Mau Mau Revolt, which is the name the British gave it, rather than, you know. But, I mean, to be fair, I mean, I did some work on this quite early, but the major thing is a book by a bloke called David Edgerton, an American, and he did a really good book on Kenya where he didn't have the same sort of detail. He didn't get down to the street level in the way that Anderson does. I think, you know, Anderson really, it's almost like a sort of book version of the Battle of Algiers when he gets onto the streets of Nairobi. Edgerton didn't accomplish that, but nevertheless, what he did was have a fine volume where he, I think, very effectively dealt with the way in which the British conducted the war. And what's interesting is the book was ignored. The book didn't have any ripple at all. And I kind of feeling that it's not just Anderson's scholarship, but it's also the fact that it's coincided with Iraq and Abu Ghraib, and if you like, there has been an audience more receptive to that revelation than when Edgerton wrote his book. And you know, the fact of the matter is, when you look at what went on in Kenya, it's worse than what's gone on that we know of in Iraq. And you know, it's dreadful. I mean, they hanged over 1,000 people. They hanged over 60 men for administering illegal oaths. This is not the 1250s or the 1550s. This is the 1950s. And also, they hanged them with very little objection. And there's no doubt in my mind, one of the reasons there was so little objection is because they were black. You know, absolutely, you could hang these blokes because they were black. Even in somewhere like Malaya, you know, where there's capital punishment, they don't hang anything like the same number of people. It's because they were black, and they hanged. I mean, there was a bloke hanged for possessing 2 rounds of ammunition. There was a group of men hanged. They'd escaped from an internment camp, and in escaping, they'd taken the guard's firearm, and they were hanged for being in possession of his firearm. Terrible things were done. This was in my lifetime, in the 1950s. But, you know, it was covered up by deliberate... I mean, the colonial secretary actually admitted that he spent most of his time trying to cover up what was going on in Kenya.
How was the war sold at home, at the empire sold at home?
I mean, there's a big argument about this still going on. You've got a number of historians, for example, who argue that there was very little interest in the empire for most of the time. The idea that everyone in Britain was, you know, sort of pro-empire is an exaggeration. I mean, Bernard Porter, in a recent book, for example, is arguing that interest in the empire is exaggerated. I accept some of what he says. You know, that I mean, when I was at school, you had the home and colonial shops And if you remember, you know, that you had the Home and Cologne. You know, you couldn't get more empire than that. The actual, you didn't go to Sainsbury's. You went to the Home and Colonial. You know, this was one of the main shops. I mean, I'm sure we're not the only ones who remember it. So I think there was more of it than perhaps Porter lets on about. But what I would argue is that there were occasions when it was important they could generate that sort of interest. So that, you know, the Egyptians nationalising the Suez Canal, there's no doubt in my mind a lot of working class people's attitude was they're taking something of ours. You know, I mean, my dad's attitude was they're taking something of ours. Completely false, but normally he wouldn't give a monkey's about the empire. But I think on occasions they could generate that sort of interest. But, you know, when it was important, they could turn it on. And the rest of the time it was there, but at a low level. Like I say, you know, when it was important, they could deliver.
Yes?
Just supplementary to the questions about Kenya, what was the date of the adjutant book? You didn't mention it.
I think it's the 70s. I reviewed it, but I honestly can't remember. I think it's still in print.
The other thing is that there is also another excellent history besides the Anderson one, which you haven't mentioned.
Caroline Elkins.
Yeah,
is that
and
one?
That
yeah.
Needs to be.
Yeah. No. Absolutely.
Parallel.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. It's like you wait for books on Kenya and two come along together. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes. Go.
You know, these are just off the cuff thoughts, if you like. I must admit, I think a lot of the make poverty history stuff, well, obviously, I'm sure we all, you know, it's not, they've got no real intention of anything. A lot of it is publicity, PR stuff. And that while I'm sure a lot of the people involved are absolutely genuine, I think, you know, they are fodder, if you like, for cynical, unscrupulous politicians. My reading of the situation is based on other people's work, but as far as I can see today, the big question for Africa is which countries are going to have oil and how are the Chinese and the Americans going to fall out over influence in Africa. I think this is likely to be the story for the future. You know, you have Chinese influence in Africa growing considerably. I think there is going to be a falling out with the United States, and we, of course, will be on the side of the United States. But in all honesty, I'm not that well informed. I'd be kidding you if I tried to make some sort of definitive statement, as I was tempted to do. But I thought I might not get away with it.
Yeah, one thing is interesting. I mean, having read the book, one thing that's interesting to me is the way that it's turned from, you know, you're talking about using nationalism, did people believe in the empire? Now it seems to be the government's using terror to try and hold people to the idea of Britishness and being together in the face of an evil opposition. So there has been a big change in how they try and hold us together. But the other subtext of that is the racism of the whole empire and the way that's also been used. And the way that it's changed, you know, in my lifetime from the Irish and the blacks to illegal immigrants and to Muslims now. And also, you know, in parallel, the complete denigration of other cultures. I mean, it came to a talk last month by Robin Walker on the book When We Ruled, which is behind you, which is a brilliant, you know, talk about, you know, brilliant discussion of what actually was there before we. And the whole wiping out of other people's history, it's not just about imposing our own version, but it's about the complete and utter wiping out of other people's history. And, you know, I know you mentioned the Bengal famine, but there's another book called Late Victorian Holocaust, which if people haven't read, they should do, about millions of people died under British rule in India at the end of the 19th century and in China in famine. And it's destroying civilians and civilian infrastructure and killing people by neglect deliberately, or actually quite deliberately, is nothothing new. And it's, you know, this book is very good, but I think, you know, we have to read it in conjunction with other things to understand exactly the wider picture and put a positive side on what was there as well, because otherwise the whole make poverty history, and even today there's a letter in one of the newspapers saying, you know, they talk about Nigerian fraud scam where people say, oh, you know, pay us, you know, give us your bank details and we'll send you £1 million, and saying, well, what about do you really feel sorry for people who lose money to that sort of scam, because they are trying to rip money out of Africa? You know, could you just blame Africans, big men in Africa, as one recent history
that's being pushed in other bookshops at the moment does. Can you really just blame them without blaming the whole system and actually saying it wouldn't happen unless you had a system that's driven by profit, and the bulk of those profits and people controlling it are based in Britain and America, although you're Western America.
I mean, I agree with you. I mean, the Mike Davis book is, you know, yeah, tremendous book, absolutely wonderful book. And what's interesting is that, you know, he covers ground that you have all the people who have been writing the histories of the British Empire somehow seem to have missed, you know, 3 million dead or whatever it is, and it's unnoticed. It is just incredible. Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry I haven't written your book, but I've got two questions. One, how far back in the British Empire do you go in your book? Because you've only done very recent, from 1948 to present. And the other thing is, I'm wondering how the Second World War would come into your analysis of the British Empire, which I think is slightly different to other wars, but maybe it's not in your eyes, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, the book goes back to the struggle against black slavery in the Caribbean. And I suppose the first event, if you like, that I focus on is the revolt in Jamaica in 1831. You know, that's the first focus of the book. And then it looks at a number of episodes, if you like, rather than being a history of the whole empire. Yeah. In terms of the Second World War, I mean, I must admit, when I started out doing the research for the book from the position of someone who considered themselves an anti-imperialist, and I must admit, the more I found out, the more shocked I was, and I thought I knew a lot of the stuff already. But one of the things that struck me about the book, about the period, for example, is when you look at the Second World War, you've not just got the Bengal famine, but you've got the Quit India movement. You had the situation there where the Congress Party made clear that they were opposed to fascism. In fact, Nehru, for example, had a much better anti-fascist reputation than any conservative member of the British government. A much better anti-fascist reputation, they made quite clear that they wanted independence. They wanted a British commitment to turning the war into an anti-imperialist war. As well as being a war against fascism, and they never got that. And I think, while on the one hand you can see, you know, that in terms of defeating fascism, you know, this was something that was for the good of humanity, if you like. By the same token, I would still say that the British and the Americans were not so much concerned about defeating fascism as such. They were primarily concerned with sustaining the British Empire and creating the circumstances for an American empire. And I don't think there's any doubt in my mind that was, you know, as Churchill put it, I've not become His Majesty's First Minister to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. He had, but, you know, that's not, you know, what he intended. And I think when you look at the Indian example, you can see absolutely clearly that the suppression of the Quit India movement was a demonstration that, as far as both the Labour and the Conservative were concerned, they were protecting the British Empire. That's not to say there wasn't anti-fascism there as well, but they were defending the British Empire. And a lot of the Conservatives certainly, you know, would have been quite happy to have done deals with the fascists if they thought they could have, you know. But in order, you know, if that had helped defend the British Empire. But I think, you know, there are the two things there. But certainly, as far as the people running the country were concerned, you know, defending the British Empire was not negotiable. That was absolutely what it was about, you know. And they were fighting the fascists really because defending the British Empire had forced them into that position, rather than any principled objection to fascism as such.
It's a very important and valuable what your books like yours, but I think it's important to show how Britain and imperialism maintains its power. It's not just through force, it's through ideology, and it's through co-option of particular ruling, you know, the local ruling class is a collaborator with imperialism. Just to say it's just foreigners coming in, taking over a country. We see in the Arab world now that there's Arab ruling classes are cooperating with what's going on in Iraq, what's going on in probably a war on Iran, in Palestine. Palestine not just not being sold because the Arab world is not, you know, the Arab ruling class is completely in cahoots with American and British imperialism.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that absolutely. And if I was, you know, I think that is a genuine criticism of the book as well. I think that there is not enough in the book on the old divide and rule stuff. And I quite accept that. I think that, I did an earlier book on British counterinsurgency. And, that is, in every chapter, that is central to the way the British, how effective they were at dividing and ruling, determine whether they won or lost any particular war. But that was not the real concern of this particular book. And I think it is a genuine criticism of it. But the main purpose of the book, from my point of view, was, I suppose, to try and counter the Neil Ferguson that sort of approach. But I do accept that as a theoretical account of imperialism, it's not intended to be a theoretical account of imperialism. And I can quite accept that there are things that could well have been there. But in my defence, it was intended to try and do another job of work. And the book's not been reviewed anywhere. Yeah, you can go in any number of bookshops and you can look at the Imperial History section if they have one, and it'll have everyone else's book, but not that one. I think that's fair to say. But what I like to think is that you will have academics in universities teaching the Empire and suddenly find that one of their students has got a copy of my book and they've not read it. And that they're confronted with, but I do accept what you say. There are weaknesses in the book, but hopefully, what it was intended to do, it does actually do. But I agree with you. This is my tactic for the night.
Agree with it. Let me say. Is there anyone else like to say something? Yes.
I think we've got to be careful in this day and age, because there is the whole argument that the problem with the problem in the third world, in Africa and Arab states, is the Arab leaders. And we've got to be clear, although they are part of the problem, they're not the whole problem. And
they are part of the problem.
They are part of the problem, but it's actually, it actually ends up coming down to a racist, there's a racist subtext to the argument, which is that actually black people and Arab peoples aren't suitable for self-government and they need a guiding hand, which has always been one of the justifications for imperialism. We're helping them because they can't help themselves. And they are part of the problem, but it's also used by some people in this in this country as an excuse not to do anything about the real cause of the problems and within the West. We've got to be careful about that, because that is an argument that you encounter an awful lot now, especially with the Make Poverty History, and saying that we give all this aid to Africa. They don't put, it's just like saying that you've got corrupt leaders in Africa. Yes, you do have, but they wouldn't be there without the support of the West, without the far bigger amounts of money coming back out into Western capital, going back to Western capitalists. And that's, there's a racist subtext that is used in that argument about the problem is it's a class issue, but it's also an issue of race.
I don't think you're disagreeing with each other. I think, the two things stand together. I mean, I think you're right in that, but nevertheless, it's a matter of a balanced analysis to see what obtains in particular circumstances. And generalisations, you have to be careful of generalisations. But there's no doubt, if you look at, the classic, I love this story. There's some of you might, have any come across Magsaysay, who was the American client in the Philippines? This bloke was ostensibly an independent ruler who aligned himself with the United States. But there's a marvellous story where when he's running for president, he's got a CIA minder, a bloke called Ed Lansdale, some of you might have come as The Quiet American, the Graham Greene book supposed to be based on Lansdale. And at one point, Magsaysay says, I want to employ my own speechwriter. And Lansdale says, no, you've got to have our CIA speechwriter. And Magsaysay says, no, I really think if I'm going to win, I've got to have my own speechwriter. So Lansdale decked him. He just whacked him and knocked him out. And I think, that's a particular circumstance that you can see that this man was absolutely in their pockets. He was useful to them as a sort of posing as an independent leader. But, you have to look at it in a particular context. Not every American ally has actually been punched in the face by their CIA minder. You know, and I think from that point of view, you know, you're both covering a nuance of attitudes rather than it being necessarily polarised. That's a nice way of putting it, actually.
Well, can I just come in there, because I just perhaps there's a kind of question as well, but because one of the things I didn't know when I published the book was that occasionally when John in his busy life couldn't make it, I'd have to go and talk about the book and stuff like that. And one of the arguments I've put is to talk about Neil Ferguson, which unfortunately, from many points of view, has sold more copies. You know, it's a mass bestseller with big, you know, business behind it. And one of the Ferguson's arguments is that he can't quite say the British brought democracy to the empire, though he'd probably like to, but he says that British brought efficient government and laid the basis for kind of, you know, backward countries entering modernity and stuff. And one of the superb criticisms that I've read of it, a very brilliant thing by a guy called Vivek Chibba, he says, look, actually, one of the things about the British Empire is it was remarkably good, much better than the rulers who it displaced in India and so forth, at letting its subjects starve. You know, had this machinery, you know, one of the points that Mike Davis makes is that, yeah, they built the railways, but they used it to ship food for export during these famines and stuff. And it's, I mean, I know it's a fact, but my hunch is, because the whole question of independence and what comes after is quite a delicate argument, but it does seem to me that if you look at India, you know, for all the limitations of independence and so forth, and it clearly varied from place to place, partly how the British determined it, and the balance of forces and independence and so forth, that there hasn't been anything like the Bengal famine once India became independent. And that clearly seems to me to say, whatever the limits of an independent capitalist India, it was clearly a step forward. I don't know if that's right, what you think, but no, it seems to me, right, you know, the Green Revolution and all the rest of it.
Well, I mean, you can put it down quite crudely that for a domestic government to let its people starve is considerably more problematic politically than for an imperial government. You know, that if you look at Ireland, for example, the Irish famine, there's no doubt in my mind that one of the reasons why the Irish starved was because, without any question, you know, it was a colony. You know, if it hadn't been a colony, there'd been a revolution. Because it was a colony, the British state was in a position to stop a revolution in Ireland. And I think you can see, you know, you can see this. It is the colonial relationship that in the end was decisive, because a domestic government would either try to feed the population to avoid rebellion, or would be overthrown by the rebellion, you know, when it failed to do that. And I think this is, you know, an imperial government can ride out famine, whereas a domestic government is more inclined to feel it's got to do something about it. And, not always, but I think
any last generally points, people, yes.
Yeah, just on that point, I would have thought that in the long run, if you let the people starve in the colonies, they're going to turn against you and say, we want independence, you know, fuck this for a deal. I would have thought, you know, in the long run interests of British imperialism, they would feed their colonies, you know, like in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and so on. You know, I find it short-sighted, if this is what you're saying.
Well, I mean, if you look at Ireland, for example, though, you know, I would say the fact of the matter in Ireland is that the potential for revolution, as the famine goes on, in the end, it is destroyed by the famine. You know, that in the end, the starvation actually undermined the capacity for resistance.
Yeah, but surely it turns the people against
I suppose it did. Well, if you, I mean, yeah, I suppose you're right, actually. Yeah. I mean, if you look at you have the Fenian movement in the 1860s, is a mass movement, you know, has something like 50,000 members, bigger than the IRA, for example, ever was subsequently. And there's no doubt that was fueled both in Ireland and in the States by the famine. But nevertheless, you know, I suppose at the height of Britain's imperial power, it could withstand something like the Fenian movement much more effectively than it could withstand, say, the much smaller IRA organisation in the 1920s. I suppose it comes down, once again, to looking at specific circumstances. But in principle, I suppose you're right, but they don't seem to behave like that. They've got the strength in terms of troops and police to ride it out, whereas a domestic government, I think, would have had its own troops and police turning against it, but the imperial government rides it out. And while I accept what you say, it might store up problems for the future. I mean, Nehru, for example, said that the 43 famine ended any moral claim the British had to rule India. Mind you, he'd said that on a number of other occasions as well. But you know, you can see this was so terrible that bloody hell, how can you justify remaining here after you've stood by and let these people die? But I'd still say that an imperialist government isn't as bothered about famine as a domestic government will be, because I still think it wouldn't feel as threatened. But I'll take your general point. Yeah.
Is there anyone else who perhaps
has come
in?
Yeah,
perhaps
thing.
The last one.
What is the... You've made several references to the Ferguson position and the Roberts position, but I'm not sure what that is.
I think they both regard the British Empire as a really good thing. And they both think that the United States should openly and unambiguously carry on in the same traditions. To be blunt, that's what it is. Ferguson thinks in terms of money. You know, he's more in the commercial side of the empire. I think Roberts is much more, let's shoot people. He's much more of that inclination. You can imagine that Ferguson is in the counting house working out the profit and loss, and Ferguson is and Roberts is out there breaking heads. I think that's where they're both coming from. Having said that, you know, they have both written earlier books that even though you don't like their politics, you can learn things from. I would say that both Ferguson and Roberts have written books that contain, where they have uncovered material that is of interest to socialists, even though that they're both very reactionary and have always been reactionary. What I think is that they've both turned into absolute ideologues, and their recent publications are of no real interest at all, because they're just, you know, they're just trying to produce a history that is supporting the American Empire and its future adventures. So I think they don't actually have anything that is of interest to say in terms of learning from them. You still have to read them because, you know, you want to know what crap they're coming. I mean, I'll put it rather crudely. They don't write books now. They go for a dump. That's a bit crude, and, you know. But I think there's a. I don't think that's completely unfair. I don't think either of them have got anything of interest to say at the moment, because they are writing propaganda for the Republican Party.
The problem is that, in the Daily Mail, there's a whole two-page article about how good the British Empire was, and that is read by millions of
people.
Didn't
he have a column in the Daily Mail first?
No, it was an article.
One of them had a column in one of the papers as well.
I saw the
Mail. Ferguson actually had a column in one of the tabloids. You know,
yeah, well, the one I saw was a two-page thing of how great the British Empire was, and that's the problem, because millions of people read that, and that's the only thing they read.
That's right. I mean,
I don't know, going about my wonderful book, but I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, there's been it's not been reviewed anywhere, and any success it has, in all honesty, will be by word of mouth. Simple as that. There's been a total...
You don't think you're going to get a two-page article in the Daily Mail?
See, on one hand, you think that'd be great, but you imagine what it would say. Sack this man. Here is his address. That's the trouble.
All right, I think if there's a little pressing, that we'll... thanks for coming. Good night.